we're not gonna talk about more.
Oh well, the Mordelidae are in the Tenebrionoidea.
Ah, okay. Oh, the it does say that. Yep.
Tenebrionoidea, the superfamily. So, yeah, we're going to talk about the Mordelidae. Mordelidae is an easy family to recognize, and they do occur around here. You may have caught some. They're pretty. They're not uncommon at all. So. We always like to say when we're out there, we want to catch one more Delid. One more Delid. So, the Tenebrionoidea. Now we're into this group. If you remember the tarsal formula hints up there, now we're into the superfamily that has the 554. These are usually... Yeah, some of them are small. Small to fairly large in size. The eyes are often emarginate. We're talking about the whole superfamily. So usually the eyes are emarginate. The antennae are usually 11 segmented. The front coccyx are often contiguous. That is, they're placed close together. The metacoccyx are usually transverse. And as I said, the tarsal formula is usually 554. The first family we will look at is the Mordelidae, the tumbling flower beetles. And they're called that because if you catch one in your net, you can see it in the net doing it too, but you can get it out in your hand and they'll just kind of tumble all around. They don't really crawl off, and they will eventually take flight and fly away, but at first they just kind of tumble around every which way in your hands. The tarsi are 554. The body shape is fairly distinctive. It's just, they're kind of wedge-shaped, so it kind of goes back almost V-shaped or wedge-shaped, goes to a point posteriorly, and when you look at them from the side, they're kind of humpback-shaped. And the end of the abdomen often sticks out, the little pointed abdomen sticks out just beyond the elytra. The head is bent downwards. These are usually fairly small. I've seen a few a little bit bigger, but 3 to 7 millimeters in length. Pronotum is margined laterally, so it has a sharp edge laterally. And the front coccyx cavities are open behind in these Tenebrionoidea. There's some that are open and some that are closed. This is one that their front coccyx cavities are open. Remember, open, they'll be right on the back margin of the prosternum, that the prosternum doesn't completely enclose the front coccyx. These are usually brown or mottled brown and grayish. Adults feed on flowers. Larvae are predaceous on other insects in rotten wood. A few larvae are stem miners. So, but it's an interesting little group. And like I said, they're caught around here fairly commonly. There's a good chance you have some Mordelids. Then that brings us to the Tenebrionidae. The Tenebrionidae, these kind of take the place of the carabids when you get into the more arid southwestern parts of the U.S. And this is a big family, lots of species all over the place. But in the eastern United States, when you think of beetles on the ground, it's usually the carabids, ground beetles. But when you get the more arid southwestern parts of the U.S., when you think of beetles on the ground, it's mostly Tenebrionidae. There's not as many carabids. The Tenebrionidae, they tend to have the fronds kind of projecting like a shelf over the antenna. So the antenna comes in and it's up underneath this shelf, and that expanded fronds intrudes into the eye and makes that eye emarginate. Yeah. So, large family, fifth largest in the Coleoptera. Fronds produced over antennal sockets and into an margination of the eyes. The antennae are usually more or less filiform, maybe manilliform or slightly clavate. As you can see, and I think there's several handouts, we'll look at them, but most, or when you think of tenebrionids, what comes to mind mostly are some black or dark colored beetles that are kind of all one color that look a little bit like carabids. But as you can see, there are quite a few others very distinctively shaped. That one on this first handout in the lower left hand corner, those pale areas are actually bright reddish orange. So there are some tenebrionids that look quite different. The one at the bottom center is very distinctly different. Very roughened, has a couple horns going out over the head. In fact, when I did my defense at Auburn University, it was well known that the systematist there had a cigar box of about 10 or 20 insects that he brought to every student's oral exam and asked, you know, tell me this family, tell me that family, tell me this family. Thing is, he didn't change them out, so we all knew what was in there, and sure enough, he had one of those in there. And right away I said, oh, that's a tenebrionidae. I was ready, and he seemed so disappointed that I knew that. How do you know that?
So the main thing that sets these apart is that fronds.
Yeah, that's a big character. I mean, the 554 gets it to this superfamily, so it narrows it down to just a handful of families. And then that's pretty diagnostic, that shelf-like thing going over the eyes or over the antennal socket. When he said, how do you know that that's a tenebrionidae? I said, oh, well, it's got an 11-segmented filiform antennae, and I might have mentioned that shelf-like thing. And he's like, well, okay, that's right. But what else? Most of these are scavengers on decaying vegetation, animal dung, seeds, cereal. Oh, here I mean, the body's shape is variable, again, brown or black, some marked with red. Tarsal formula is 554, and the front coxal cavities are closed behind. This family. There are some pest species. Some get into stored grains and flowers. They're called the red or the confused flower beetle. The immatures are called mealworms, and so sometimes they're in stored grains and things like that. Some live in termite nests. Again, lots of variability in this size, shape, and even coloration. Let's see. Again, Jerry likes to show you a lot of the exceptions, so you get that the idea that this family, by looking at his handouts, oh wow, they just really look a lot different. Well, these are the kind of the exceptions. Most of them are more carabid-like in shape and that. Let's see, is there a picture of one of them? Oh yeah, it's on the next handout, I think. It says a lot of these will live in the desert, arid areas. You can see that one picture there, the upper left-hand corner, this Eleoides. It has the habit of, at night, taking this position with its rear end up in the air and its head down low. You have any idea why it might do that?
Thermoregulation.
Well, it's at night, and so it's not really a heat thing.
Yeah. It's hunting?
What's going on is, at night, if there's any moisture in the air, it might condense as dew on it.
Oh, it's...
And they do that, and so that the dew will run down their bodies towards their head where they can drink the water.
That is really cool, actually.
Um, Then the next handout is another one of those situations where we used to teach this as a whole separate family, but now they've been rolled into the, or incorporated into the Tenebrionidae. This is the Alaculinae now. Used to be the Alaculidae, but these are called the comb-clawed beetles. They essentially have all the characters that the Tenebrionidae had, but they had on their claws a series of little teeth. Doesn't show up real good on this, and especially mine's wearing out, but there's supposed to be little tiny teeth on the inside of those claws there to the far left. And so that's why they're called the comb-clawed beetles. So again, they're, most of the species are western in the U.S. Used to be a separate family. Now they're subfamily in the Tenebrionidae. Again, the claws are called pectinate, those little teeth. But again, they still have the 5-5-4 tarsal formula. The front coxal cavities are closed behind, just like in the Tenebrionidae. Again, elongate oval brown beetles. I'm not sure if these, if we have any species of these up in North Dakota. We got them down in the south when I was down there. Adults are on flowers and foliage and things like that. Now there's several things that we don't cover. This next one is the Lagrianae. Used to be a separate family again. Now it's been rolled into the Tenebrionidae also, but we don't require anything about it. The next one is the Edamaridae. We used to require this family, but we don't anymore. So it's not a required family. Just for your information, one of the things that we look for in this one is that the pronotum tends to be narrowed right in front of the elytra. Mm-hmm. So you can see it's a little wider in the middle and becomes narrowed next to the elytra, and at least in a lot of the species. But again, it's not a family we require anymore. The next one that we do require, another important family, is the blister beetles, the Meloidae. What do you guys know about Meloids? They have a defensive substance that they can excrete and cause kind of a burning sensation. Most of the time, when I see blister beetles, I handle them with my hands and never have any trouble. I don't know with the skin on your hands is, I don't know, I've never had trouble picking up with the hands. The one time I had problem, and I can't be sure it was a blister beetle, but I think it was collecting beetles or collecting bugs at lights down in Mexico. Mm-hmm. And when you're in the tropics, things are coming in like crazy. Just got to get used to things on getting on you. But something landed on the back of my neck, and my impulse was just to wipe it off, and all of a sudden just a searing pain went right down my neck and stuff. And so I think that was probably a blister beetle got me. So blister beetles, one of the characters, these are often more soft-bodied. The elytra's not really hard. It's more leathery. In blister beetles, over here to the far left, you see this close-up of the tarsi and the claws. Well, they'll have the pair of claws drawn in there. And then at the base of each one, there's another little blade coming out. So there's a pair of blade-like structures coming out right at the base of each tarsal claw.
Those had a specific name, didn't they?
Those blades?
Yeah.
I don't know that I have one in here.
Okay, never mind.
Elongate soft-bodied tarsal formula 5-5-4, claws each with a lower blade, tooth, or spine.
Okay.
Front coxal cavities are open behind. The thorax tends to be somewhat narrowed. Most species, it's narrower than the head and the elytra. The pronotum is rounded laterally. The head is kind of deflects downwards. There are some species that are bright metallic in coloration. Adults are usually plant feeders, phytophagous. A few don't feed at all, but there's a good number of them that tend to be on legumes, which would be like clovers and alfalfa. And so they can cause some damage to alfalfa in that, but where they can really be a problem is that these are very toxic to horses. If horses eat like one specimen, it can kill them. Incredibly toxic. And of course you're feeding your horses alfalfa, so these things are on alfalfa. Even dead ones, if there happen to be a dead one in the alfalfa, it can cause problems. So the immatures, some of them are parasites, or I guess they almost call them predators, on grasshopper eggs. And some are parasites on bees, in bee nests, the immatures. In their life cycle, they go through hypermetamorphosis. You know hypermetamorphosis? Hypermetamorphosis. Yep.
Normal metamorphosis.
Hypermetamorphosis. Do that word in Hangman sometime.
Several different forms in development.
Yep. This is where there's different forms in the immature stage. This is where it's come. The adults, oftentimes you'll find them sitting on flowers and on that, and they'll lay their eggs in the flowers. The first instar immatures are very active insects. They can crawl around and move, have legs and everything. And when a bee comes to the flower, they'll jump on the bee and ride on the bee back to its nest. And once it's in its nest and becomes parasitic on the bees and the bee larvae, they don't have any real reason to move around anymore. So then the later instars lose their legs or become sessile and non-mobile, more sedentary. And so that's what hypermetamorphosis is when there's a very big difference between the different immature stages, that you'll usually have a very active, you know what they call that first active stage? There's another fancy term for that. The official, more of an official name, back when we talked about this like in the scales and stuff, we called those crawlers. But here, we call that first stage a triungulum. Huh. As you've already talked about, the adults exude a chemical substance from their knees or different parts of the body. This substance, this is where sometimes you wonder, but the substance contains a chemical called cantharidin. Cantharidin, but I guess what I was getting at is you would expect the cantharidae to have cantharidin in them. And maybe they do, I don't know. But it's well known or talked about, at least here in the blister beetles. And that, what's interesting is that Spanish fly, which is sometimes used as an aphrodisiac, also has cantharidin in it. And so sometimes they've harvested blister beetles to get the cantharidin out of it. So
do they have to distill the irritant down to get the cantharidin?
I don't know. I don't know how they do it, what the process is. Like I said, this contains material called cantharidin, which is a defensive chemical secretion. May have some pheromonal activity in primitive species. There is cantharidin in Spanish fly, used to be thought to be an aphrodisiac. Um, And this is the substance that can cause blisters, so.
Oh. That was thought to be an aphrodisiac?
Yeah, I don't know how all that relates. I'm just, yeah. So. Yeah, I haven't delved into it. I never thought I needed an aphrodisiac and never wanted to experiment with cantharidin from the crude extract. I don't know how they process it, if there's some way that it eliminates the blister making properties or what. But anyway, I just tell it as it is in my notes. There are some that have the wings, the body really enlarged and the wings small. The females in that, you can see that down there in the lower left-hand corner. But they're browns and blacks, metallics. We did, there was one time, one of our trips, when I was a PhD student, we went out west and there was some place we stopped in some town and there were street lights on a road that I don't think there was hardly any houses, and we stopped and looked in the ground and there was blister beetles all over the place that had come to the lights, and lots of different species. It wasn't all one, it was a lot of different species in there. But, all right, the next family we'll talk about . This is a smaller family, both in size and in numbers of species, but it's the Anthicidae. Do you not have a...
I have
Pyrocordia
next.
Oh. Oh, good. You have a handout on that. I don't even know if I have a handout on... Oh, yeah, I got it farther on. But Pyrocroidae is a not required family. You got one on the Milan Dryadi also, that's not required either. Yeah.
Ant-like flower beetles.
I just moved those on the other side of the Anthicidae, I guess, so. So yeah, the Anthicidae are the ant-like flower beetles. And here in these pictures, they might not look much like an ant, but when you see them in real life, they do look kind of like little ants. They're reddish-brown or brownish in color. They are somewhat ant-like in appearance. The head is deflexed, with kind of a strongly constricted neck area behind the head. That helps give them a little bit more of an ant-like appearance. In this group, the eyes are not emarginate, they're entire. There's a little bit of an exception in the Tenebrionoidea, that the eyes are entire. There are some species that have the pronotum produced almost like a hood or a horn over the head. That's what you can see kind of down there in the center bottom row, and then the side view showing that pronotum going out over the head. The tarsal formula is 5-5-4. Front coxal cavities are open behind. The adults are found on flowers. Larvae are in vegetable debris or feeding on plants. Again, it's a... I don't know. I think they occur around here. I've collected them many times. I just don't remember where. As I said, the Milan Dryads are not required anymore. And the Pyrocroids are not required. And then that brings us to the next superfamily. That was the Tenebrionoidea. Now we have the Chrysomeloidea. Here, in this superfamily, the tarsal formula is, strictly speaking, it's 5-5-5, but the fourth segment is usually very small and concealed in a lobe third segment, so it really looks like it's 4-4-4. Your tarsal formula rules, we got it up here, is saying, well, it's apparently 4-4-4. So the fourth segment is very small. So tarsal formula apparently 4-4-4, actually 5-5-5 with the fourth very small and concealed. The antennae are usually filiform or clavate, but they're not usually distinctly clubbed. So filiform or maybe slightly clavate, but not a well-defined club usually. We're only going to discuss two families in the Chrysomeloidea, but both families are quite large, and both families have a number of subfamilies that we'll talk about. The two families we'll talk about are the Cerambycidae and the Chrysomelidae, of course. And so the first one we'll talk about is the Cerambycidae. Everybody likes Cerambycidae, don't they? Huh? The longhorn beetles, called longhorn beetles because most species have very long antennae, usually at least half the length of the body, oftentimes as long as the whole body or even longer. As we'll see, there are some exceptions, but most of the time the antennae are quite long. The antennae are often filiform, although in some species they can be more serrate to pectinate. There's one a number of years ago, 10 years ago or so, I was at one of the ESA meetings and somebody had a poster up on a South American species. There's a species in South America that actually has evolved a sting on the end of their last antennal segment. They could actually sting you with their antennae. I just never heard of anything like that in the whole insect stuff, that be able to sting with their antennae. But that's so cool.
So is it kind of like a hypenoptera?
Not really a sting, no. I don't think it's like a sting that they would, I mean, that's evolved ovipositor, I don't remember. It's just whether it's a modified hair that has some, became kind of a spine with some toxin in it that it can do or whatever, but it would, yeah. Again, antennae are filiform, usually more than half the length of the body, hence the common name. The first antennal segment is usually relatively long, at least compared to the second segment. It's usually at least five times longer than the second segment. The eyes are often emarginate, again. Here it's often by the antennae. The antennae, the base of the antennae intrude into the eyes, or the eyes wrap around the base of the antennae. Body is usually somewhat elongated and parallel-sided. These can be a little bit bigger beetles. Some of them are quite large. The tarsal formula is, like we said, for the superfamily, apparently 444. There's a few species that one segment's not quite as small, and so it does appear to be truly 555. The taxonomy of this group is pretty good. One is that they're another popular group for collectors. Cerambycids can really be spectacular with the colors and patterns, and the long antennae are just really interesting. And so there's been a lot of people that have worked on this group. When I went to French Guiana, that trip we went to Puerto Rico first, and we thought Puerto Rico would be, it's a U.S. territory, that would be an easy part of the trip. And it turned out that it was the worst part. I mean, it was good collecting, but everywhere we went, there was people coming up to us saying, "You shouldn't be here. This is," we were up on one mountain. They said, "Down in the capital, they steal cars and bring them up here and piece them out. You're up here in a bad area." And sure enough, one place we were, somebody, while we were blacklighting with the generators going off the road, we couldn't hear anything happening in our car. But somebody came and tried to break into the trunk of our car. They let the air out of one of our tires and tried to break into the trunk. And what happened? They couldn't get into the trunk, but they messed the lock up so bad we couldn't get in there to get the spare tire out. So we actually flagged some guy down who was going into the military the next day. And he was going out into the wilderness with his girlfriend for one last night. But we stopped him and said, do you know how to get into a trunk? He said, oh yeah, no problem. I'll be in there in a second. Boom, he popped. But anyway, it got off topic there. But then we went to French Guiana. We knew nothing about French Guiana, nothing. And the guy that hosted us there was so wonderful. He provided us with big generators and big lights and everything. But he was a Serambisid worker. That's why I got onto the story. He worked on Serambisids. And he showed us his collection he had down there. And he just would go through these drawers and going, new species, new genera, new species. Just everything was something undescribed, at least according to him. So anyway, but again, a lot of people have worked, and because it is a popular group. It's almost like the butterflies of other groups, that a lot of people like to collect butterflies, and so a lot of people work on the taxonomy. This is another one that's like that. Most are phytophagous, or all are phytophagous. Most of the brightly colored species, the adults, will be out on flowers and things. The more drab colored ones are usually more nocturnal, or you'll find them mostly on dead logs and trees and branches. These do attack trees. A lot of hardwood species. These have a tendency to attack more dead trees or dying trees. Whereas the Buprestids, if you go back and think about the metallic wood-boring beetles, they had a tendency to attack healthier trees a little bit more. Again, the birch trees around here and emerald ash borer and that. But these tend to sometimes attack healthier trees, but more often the dead and dying trees. There are some that are called girdlers, and so they may go to a good healthy tree, but the adults will actually chew a groove or chew all the way around a branch and girdle it, and so then what's going on out then will die, and that's where they lay their eggs, on this dying branch. So what else? Oh, these in cross-section, the immatures tend to be more rounded. So if you open up a log and you can see the galleries, the Buprestids are a little bit more flattened. And so their galleries, they look more oval, not round in shape. Whereas Serambisids, the galleries are more circular or rounded. So a lot of times you don't even have to see the immatures or the adults. You can kind of tell what's attacked that tree, whether it's Buprestids or Serambisids. These sometimes can cause problems with the lumber industry, destroying wood or discoloring the wood. But again, they also play an important role in native natural situations, on breaking down dead logs and things like that, so they can be beneficial too. They're considered beneficial. Now, as I said, there's a number of subfamilies we'll talk about on this first handout. Well, actually, the way it would go is I jump back and forth a little bit. But on this first handout, the one in the upper left-hand corner is the Perandrini. These are a little bit different than the other Serambisids. They have most of the characters of the Serambisids, but you'll notice that the antennae are not near as long. They're not reaching half the length of the body. Again, the tarsal formula in this is the group where it's distinctly 5-5-5. And these actually look a lot like, well, what family do they look like to you? Just looking at that. Something we had at the very beginning of the beetles, or towards the beginning.
Maybe Lucanid.
Lucanids. Mm-hmm. These look a lot like Lucanids. But yeah. Stag beetles had more clubbed antennae. These uh-huh. don't have the clubbed antennae.
Don't have the clubbed antennae. Yep. Just have
it. So, that next one, you see I've drawn an X through it. The Asimini is not one we cover, but that's another subfamily. They're usually flatter, and their antennae are not quite as long either, although it's about half the length of the body there. The next subfamily I will talk about is the Prionini. That's the top center and the two lower left ones on this first handout. These are often the great big, bigger, larger cerambycids you see. And then you can usually recognize them in that the lateral margins of the pronotum are kind of often toothed, have great big tooth teeth or spines. So you can see right here there's a tooth and there's another tooth. And this one here has a series of smaller teeth. And there's a couple teeth on this one. So the Prionini, these contain the largest North American species, up to 75 millimeters. And antennae may be somewhat serrate, and this is a group that often sometimes have serrate antennae. Mm-hmm. So the antennae are kind of toothed. Front coxae are transverse. Most have teeth on the lateral margins of the pronotum, which makes it margined laterally. Other subfamilies are more rounded laterally. Like I said, the front coxae are usually transverse. The other subfamilies, they're more globular. Let's see. And the way my notes go, and it's kind of convenient, is we can go to the next handout. And we'll talk about the ones that are on the left-hand side of this one. These are the subfamily Lamiini. It's written down there at the lower left-hand corner. These are kind of recognized in that the face is kind of flattened and vertical. So it looks like it has a flat vertical face on these. So they have a vertical face. The pronotum is usually a little bit narrower than the hemelytra in the head, so it almost looks like it has a neck. And in this subfamily, the apex of the maxillary palps is usually pointed. And I think that's what they're illustrating right there, that side view of the head, is that the apex of that last segment of the maxillary point is pointed. So maxillary palps pointed, I'll just say. Where in the next two subfamilies I've mentioned, it's more blunt, it's not pointed. This subfamily includes includes some important economic species. The sawyers attack various trees. You see down in the lower left-hand corner is the pine sawyer, southern pine sawyer. It can be a problem on pine trees. They often have really long antennae. There's also the genus Saperda has some important species. One's called the round-headed apple tree borer. One's called the elm borer. It also has one species that you probably have recognized, this guy right here.
Red milkweed beetle.
Catch any fairly large reddish beetles on milkweed?
I don't think I haven't. But I'm looking at the side view of that head, like, what the heck?
Well, okay, you know what the genus name for this is? Again, maybe they were done before we got out. They were common. They're usually common in the middle of the summer, towards at least through the middle of August anyway. I had a bunch in my backyard. I got milkweed, have milkweed growing in my backyard, and I always have lots of these. The genus name is Tetra opes.
Four eyes?
Literally four eyes. And it's because that antenna, like I said, the base of the antenna intrudes on the eyes, so they're in marginate. In this genus, it intrudes so far that it split the eyes into two. So it looks like it has four eyes. That's what that lateral view is showing you. You can see the antenna there, and there's an eye up there and an eye there. But it's all one eye. It's just been completely separated now by the antenna insertion.
just don't know how that would.
It's kind of a derogatory term if we call somebody four eyes, isn't it? But this is the four eyes beetle.
So is their vision kind of similar to like Gyrinids, where they have their compound eyes like separated?
Yeah. This is also the subfamily that has some twig girdlers. Now, the next one, subfamily we'll talk about, is on the right-hand side of this, is the Lepturinae. Is it spelled on there yet? Right there, Lepturinae. These are the ones that late in the year you often find them sitting on flowers. They're on goldenrod a lot. And so they're on flowers. I know we get them down in the sandhills, down there in the Mere Pool area quite frequently. But they tend to be not quite as parallel sided as the others. Notice how they're wider at the base of the elytra and narrower. So they kind of are narrowed posteriorly, generally. And again, the pronotum of the head is kind of deflects downward. So they kind of have a distinctive shape to them. So these have broad shoulders, or the elytra is tapering or narrowed posteriorly. Here now the apex of the maxillary palp is blunt or truncate. So I just put max palps blunt apically. Four coccyx are conical. The eyes are not surrounding the base of the antennae in this group. Again, these are often brightly colored yellows and oranges and are often found on flowers in that late in the summer. And then the last subfamily, I'll go back to the first handout again. And those on the right-hand side of this one is the Cerambycinae, which is spelled out several times there. But the Cerambycinae, here now again the elytra is more parallel-sided. The eyes are usually quite emarginate again in this subfamily. And here again the maxillary palps are blunt apically. The four coccyx are kind of variable, but they're usually not conical like in the last subfamily. This one includes things that are, well, like the black locust. These are kind of beautiful. Those, like the upper right-hand one is black with bright yellow. Those pale areas are bright yellow. I think some of those are kind of have some orangish color to them. Ash borer may have some orangish color to them. This is one that includes a species called the Power's Eye beetle. I don't know if that, say it's, you guys are, what I mean, I wouldn't expect Aaron. I thought Dylan might. I don't know if Dr. Bishop doesn't tell that story to you guys or not. One of his predecessor was Dr. Powers, was the guy that was there at Concordia before Bishop was Dr. Powers, and he was here while when I first got here, but he was out collecting down towards the Sandhills in the Enderlin area, I believe. Lisbon, Enderlin area, and caught some beetles that looked a lot like that locust beetle and sent it to one of the Cerambycin workers, and lo and behold, it turned out to be an undescribed species.
Oh.
And so he named it after him. It was Megasilene Power's Eye. And it's been collected down there. We have gotten it over in western Minnesota around the Felton area. It may get all the way down into the northwestern corner of Iowa, but it seems to just occur in this little area. And the adults will get on goldenrod late in the year, but they only get on there's different species of goldenrod, and it's one of them that's like a flat-topped goldenrod. It's not one as common. But we used to do things with Dr. Powers a little bit, and, you know, the it's obviously related to this black locust or this locust borer, but we don't know what the immatures are doing. And we actually took Dr. Powers down to the Sandhills one time, you know, all of us, and we were just looking for different legumes like wild licorice and some of the bushier. And we dug some up. We dug some bushes up and put them in big plastic bags and brought them back here to the lab and was hoping we'd rear some of these out and find out what the host plant for the immatures were. But we never did get any adults come out of anything. So, but anyway, that's just the interesting story about that there's one that occurs just in our area here that was named for a past professor at Concordia, Dr. Powers.
Dr. Bishop hasn't exactly talked about that, about his predecessor back in the day. I'm trying to think of anything.
Yeah.
Yeah, no, he hadn't, that I know of.
Yeah.
He could have been.
He may, well, I mean, like I said, Dr. Powers and I overlapped, so we did some stuff together. It may be that when Dr. Powers retired and Dr. Bishop came on, they didn't have a lot of communication, so he may not even know much about Dr. Powers. Dr. Powers was a very interesting man and got students excited in entomology. Mm-hmm. When I first came, we were getting graduate students from Concordia right and left. They were coming over in bunches. I had three or four working for me as student workers when they were undergraduates, and then we have always had students from Concordia. I know you're from Concordia, but we really, in the last 10 or 15 years, we haven't had very many.
Maybe two.
Yeah. So, but yeah, when I first got here, we were getting a lot of students from Concordia. He got them excited about entomology. But he was the cyanide jar guy that I told you about earlier, too.
Yep.
Cyanide jar guy?
Oh, he... Kill jars, we always just use ethyl acetate. It's safe and seems pretty easy, but he always used cyanide jars, poured the plaster with the cyanide in them, and he got the students hooked in them. These students that came over here, we would tell them, yeah, we'll make some ethyl acetate jars. Nope, I've got to have my cyanide jars. So. Wes, we're just about to quit the time, but see, on Fridays, I don't like to keep you guys over on Fridays because that's all I've got you scheduled for is a lecture. I don't think, from what I can tell, you guys don't care too much, but if I keep you lecturing longer than the hour, I usually try to just do it on Tuesdays and Thursdays because I figure I got you for lab right after scheduled. So anyway, I think we'll just quit there. We've done the Serambicidae. We've got the Chrysomelidae to do, which has got a number of subfamilies. And then all we have left is the Curculionoidea. There's a few small minor families we'll talk about. The Curculionidae itself has lots of subfamilies, but most of which we don't even talk about, except for the bark beetles is one we do. So, but anyway, I think on Tuesday we can do the Chrysomelidae yet and the Curculionidae, and then I probably can still do the Neuroptera. We might have to go for an hour and a half on Tuesday or something, but I think we can get that all done, and so we'll be at least where I was hoping we could get to right now, and then we'll on Tuesday we'll talk about when we'll have our next exam and that. But I think then that's, as I've mentioned before, I think Jerry's planning on coming in and starting lecturing some groups that he knows better than I do, and he volunteered to do the whole Hymenoptera. But I think he said he's going to start with the Strepsiptera and then go into the Hymenoptera, and then he'll go into the Lepidoptera and groups that are related to Lepidoptera. He knows Lepidoptera way better than I do. I've always done the Hymenoptera before, but since he's been working on the bees, he really knows the bees quite well. And again, he volunteered to lecture on the bees at first, and then I guess it was his idea. He said it just seemed weird if I lectured for a little bit on the Hymenoptera, and then he came in and did the bees, and then I went back to it. So he said he would just do the whole Hymenoptera. So anyway, that's where we stand. And then when he gets done with the Lepidoptera and Trichoptera, those groups that he knows quite well, then we're hoping we'll still have time. I'll come in at the end and do the Diptera. So anyway, yeah, well, the Diptera is always the last. And in the past, and you know, I should be impartial. I'm impartial, but Diptera is never my favorite group. Flies. But actually, they're very interesting. And in part, maybe it's because I don't like flies. I've tried hard to deliver a good lecture on it. I've had some students in the past say that was one of the better lectures, was on Diptera. But it gets left to the end, and we're always running behind. So we've always gotten it done. We've always gotten through everything. But I've always said that if we run so far behind, we'll just leave out the Diptera test-wise. We'll go ahead and take the test like we were supposed to. But if you guys wanted to, I would go ahead and just lecture on the Diptera so you hear about it and get exposed. But it might be too late to be included on it. But I don't know. We're not there yet, so we don't have to worry about that yet.
Yeah, but multiple families?
Yeah, there's a bunch of different kinds of weevils. The broad, the long, what are they, long snouted weevils, and the Rose curculio weevils. But yeah, weevil is not just, I mean, it's a broader term. It's,
I thought it was just a curculionidae.
Yeah. No, you'll see like the Branidae are the long, are they, what are they, the long snouted?
The primitive weevils.
Primitive weevils, okay. So yeah, we'll talk about those, the Branids, but they also rolled in the Apionidae, is now a subfamily of that one, and that contains the sweet potato weevil, which I worked on as a postdoc down in Louisiana. The guy I ended up working with after I got my PhD, he was a stink bug taxonomist. That's where I got my taxonomy training, but he had to split duties. He was also their sweet potato entomologist. And he was breeding new lines of sweet potatoes and released several new varieties, including one that's probably still one of the biggest sellers and ones that probably you guys eat all the time. It was called Beauregard. But Beauregard is a variety of sweet potatoes that he developed. But part of my postdoc was, he had all these nurseries growing sweet potato vines, and I had to strap on the old big insecticide pack and go around and spray and keep them insect-free and stuff. But anyway, that sweet potato weevil is one that would attack sweet potatoes down there pretty bad. So, but yeah, we called it the sweet potato weevil or that, but it's not truly a curculionidae. It's